Hi, this is John Campbell introducing you to Miracle Hour on bbsradio.com. Welcome to our listeners all over the world. And as I explained last week in my program, I'll be introducing a lot of really fantastic guests who have been very instrumental in my journey of what I call awakening. And if any of you would like to call in and talk to any of my guests or myself, you can call toll-free from USA on 877-876-5227 or from Canada on 888-815-9756 and from anywhere else in the world by calling 1-530-876-322 and it's bbsradio.com. Well, when I eventually got into my path of awakening, it has really been an interesting journey. One of the things that I found interesting as I got further along and learnt more were the number of people in this field whose awakening came from a very similar one as my own. In other words, a problem with drugs or alcohol or what have you. So I found that very, very interesting, and a lot of my teachers that I've met on the way came from this similar background. So today I have a very interesting guest who was one of my first counselors that I met when I went into the treatment facility that I went to. And his name's Peter Smith, and I'll be introducing him today. And it's, I think the first thing that I remember when I started to recall this period of my life was how some force seems to bring, or it brought me to a place where I had to look at the way I was leading my life. And in my case, I had a visit from a guy who I hadn't seen for 15 years, literally hadn't seen for 15 years. And he had been an old drinking buddy of mine when I worked, we worked together in Nigeria. And suddenly, as these things seem inexplicably, he made contact with me. And we met up, and I was still in my fully blown, you know, alcohol dependency, and it was a lunchtime. I remember it so well today. And he went to a lot of trouble to contact me. That's the other interesting component. You know, my number was restricted because I was involved in a professional football club, and you know, the numbers weren't listed. And so he contacted the football club, and they contacted me and wanted to know if it was okay for them to give out the number. And I did so. I mean, he was a guy I really got along well with, and we used to drink pretty much at the same level. And we went for lunch together, and I noticed immediately a difference in him. You know, he was very calm, and, you know, and he didn't drink when I invited him to have our usual drink together. And I thought that was interesting, but very strange. And so I carried on drinking throughout the meal, and he told me about he'd gone to this amazing place called Broadway Lodge in the West Country, and, you know, he was actually given the last rites in Bristol Royal Infirmary, which is a big hospital in that area of England, and that had led him to this treatment center. And he was talking about hearing the birds sing and waking up in the morning, and then this kind of, it just went over my head at the time, you know. But what I realized now was it had planted a seed, which then, in my case, took about 3 years to manifest. But eventually, 3 years later, I was in so much pain that I heard for the very first time what I call my voice, the voice which people refer to in different ways, the higher self, the divine, whatever you want to call it. But all I knew was I was hearing a voice that was prompting me to contact this guy. And again, I hadn't had any more contact from him from the day we finished that luncheon. And when I contacted him, he laughed, first of all. He said, I knew you'd call me. I didn't know how long it would take. In this case, it took 3 years. And I wanted to know all the ins and outs. Typically, you know, I wanted to know everything in those days. I had to know, you know. I had to have control. And he wouldn't do anything. He just kept giving me the telephone number. He said, just call this this place and it'll change your life. Those were his words. And amazingly, you know, I took the number down and I came off the phone, and for the very first time I turned to my wife at the time and said, look, I've got a problem, you know, and I said for the first time, you know, I'm alcoholic. And and from that moment, the craving for alcohol left me, and in my case, never returned, which is a miracle. And this is called Miracle Hour. believe me, that was a miracle for me. And I stopped drinking in that second, in that instant, and I went 5 weeks without drinking, but I was still as crazy then. I remember it was a very hot summer, and we were having a lot of barbecues, and I was inviting my drinking friends around, and I was taking great pride in pouring drinks down their throats, you know, and standing back in a very grandiose way, saying, well, I don't need any of this. And so, you know, it looked on the surface that everything was okay, but inside I was in a lot of pain, especially now that I didn't have any anesthetic. And then one day I was sat in my office and I was feeling so lonely and just absolutely rock bottom. And again, I heard the voice say, phone the number, which of course I hadn't done up to then. And I phoned the number, and it was the most amazing conversation I'd had. And phoned up Broadway Lodge, and a lovely lady said, I'll call you back and do an assessment, which she did. And after 10 minutes, I was sobbing over the phone, and you know, at the end of it, she just said some words which stuck with me forever. She said, everything's going to be okay, and that was like music to my ears. And I made the decision to enter voluntarily, you know, this treatment facility, which I didn't know a lot about, and the date was booked. And the amazing, I mean, I have to laugh at myself now when I think back to how I rolled up. And you know, I rolled up in my long Mercedes and dressed with a three-piece suit, and, you know, knocking on the door wanting to know where the jacuzzi and the hot tub was. And I think a lot of people had that. But as I entered, something happened, and I had the most amazing six, seven weeks in there, and some amazing people. And Peter, who's going to be my guest today, I'm really thrilled to have him on, was one of the counselors, and the first thing I got from the program was the educational element, which was important for me, you know, because the lectures we had kind of opened me up and got into the whole family systems and all the rest of it. I could see my brother and my sister and my mom and my dad and my wife's family. I could see everything, and it just lights were going on all over the place. And Peter I particularly enjoyed because he was a guy who did and probably still does speak with his hands, and I found that very captivating. So that's how I got there. And Peter, if you're there, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for giving up your time to be my guest on Miracle Hour today.
Yeah, not at all. It's an absolute pleasure, John. Thank you for being so kind enough to invite me.
Well, you heard, I guess you heard my introduction. You probably didn't know any of that side of it, but as I walked through the door, I'd like you, first of all, if you can, to tell our listeners a little bit about perhaps, you know, how you got involved in a 12-step program and what brought you to Broadway Lodge and when that was.
Well, I've been at Broadway Lodge now for nearly 17 years, and not untypically, you know, went with a view to staying a few years and then, you know, use it as a stepping stone to, you know, career development and move on and, you know, move up, you know, through the hierarchy and, you know, eventually become somebody, you know, very big and important. But, you know, you get there, and it's got such an atmosphere and such a warmth, and as you were saying earlier, you know, the miracles that happen there, it ends up keeping you there because it's such an important and powerful place in many respects for people, you know, who are on a journey in their own lives. And I guess it would be true to say that I was on my own journey, if not quite the same as your own. My story starts with the dysfunctional family, and I mean, actually, in fairness, I don't know a family that functions. But when you have addiction thrown in, it's clearly dysfunctional. And I have three brothers, a couple of whom have this illness. And you know, I went off to university and then ended up in a teaching career, and then moved out of teaching into business, and I found myself with a bit of time to spare, and started a sort of part-time evening course looking at the impact of alcohol on families. Now, one would question, why was I drawn to such a course? Well, you know, somewhere in there was the acknowledgement that within my own family of origin, you know, there was a problem there. And this course lasted for about eight weeks. It might have been 10 weeks, but not particularly long. You know, one or two evenings a week. And at the end of it, the group of people that were on the course with me decided that it might be a good idea just to try and set up something that would respond and support people who were out there struggling with addiction. And so we set up a telephone helpline. And that was just a voluntary thing, a couple of evenings a week, and you know, from there I really got a sense of the importance and the value of supporting people out there who can feel very alone with this illness. And one evening, just by chance, we had picked up a newspaper, and the Bristol Evening Post. Now Bristol is 30-odd miles away from here, and we never get the Bristol Evening Post. We never buy one. We rarely see one. And how this one happened to come into my possession, I do not know. Anyway, I had it. Looking through and reading all sorts of bits and pieces, most of them, you know, particularly, you know, irrelevant to our situation down here in the States, out here in the countryside. But something caught my eye. It was a job. A job in a alcohol and drug advisory center in Weston-super-Mare, and they were seeking a manager. And I guess I had no qualification, paper qualification, academic qualification, that really qualified me for the role. But I phoned up, you know, just sort of out of interest, and, well, the next thing was, you know, I was interviewed and I got the job. And that really...
This was at Broadway Lodge?
It wasn't, actually. It was a street agency in Weston-super-Mare that
Had
newly opened, actually. It had been open probably about a year. Uh-huh. And they had a manager who was moving on to the office in Bristol, and they needed to replace him in Weston-super-Mare. So I went to Weston-super-Mare and you know, started off in this role, very naive, didn't really know much about what I was doing, but had a care and a sensitivity and an empathy for the client group. And bit by bit, this agency, you know, started to grow and develop. But in the meantime, I got to know staff at Broadway Lodge. Now, Broadway Lodge was the first residential treatment centre in the UK to work with the Minnesota model. It opened in 1975, and so by the time I arrived in Weston-super-Mare, it had probably been going for sort of 15 or so, maybe a little bit more, years. And I got to know the staff very well. And, you know, I worked in Weston for a couple of years, then moved on to Bristol, and worked in the head office then for a few years. And a job came up at Broadway Lodge, and a couple of staff there said, look, you know, come and work for us. You know, we'd really like you to come and join us. So, you know, after sort of fairly agonizing, you know, few days, I decided that it was the place. And I went, and as I say, I've been there now for getting on for 17 years, and have enjoyed every minute, and stimulated, excited, you know, go off to work happily, you know, finish the end of the day feeling fulfilled. It's not always easy, and it can be very challenging, but people, it does make a difference to people's lives.
Well, I think, I mean, that's beautiful to hear your journey there, because it wasn't directly into Broadway Lodge, but it was like the stepping stones, which I see so much of. And you know, what I heard you say there was about the love and the empathy and the support, and I mean, that's what absolutely hit me as soon as I walked in, because I was in a mess. I didn't know how big I was. That was the thing that hit me, was the genuine love that I experienced, you know, from everyone in there, and that was such an experience for me. And I remember you remember that we used to have those quiet afternoon or quiet hours lying on our mats in the lecture room.
We called it relaxation.
Playing some music and that. And all I remember was sobbing, you know, just, I could not believe the amount of pain that was coming to the surface.
Yes.
And the love that, you know, from everyone in there, it is tangible, you know, and it really, you know, it was just a massive start, and it brought me such a lot of inspiration staying in there. And also I was interested, you know, what you said about the first treatment center in the UK to operate the Minnesota model. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that, Peter? What the Minnesota model means and what it involves?
Well, in its simplest form, you know, there are really two basic elements at the core. One is that it's an abstinence-based treatment, and it is rounded. It's holistic. It's treating an individual as a whole person. There are medical models. People do go off into hospital to be detoxed and dried out, and then put back on the street again, and you know, many patients coming into treatment, you know, will have experienced that, but it ends up as a bit of a revolving door, you know, that they go into hospital, they're dried out, they come out again, and very shortly they're drinking again because very little has changed for them. So this model does look at every aspect of the individual, and so at Broadway we have a therapy team, a counselling team, psychotherapy team, we have a medical team, and we have, as I heard you saying earlier, lectures and so an educational sort of input. We involve family members as best we can because they also need to start to address how addiction may have affected them, as a consequence of the family member who has this illness. The knock-on, the ripple effect can be quite significant for others, particularly those who've got an emotional investment in the individual, in the patient.
Mm.
The Minnesota model, by its name, originates from Minnesota and Hazelden in Minnesota, which really was probably where it started for Broadway Lodge's own journey, that individuals from the States came over and helped to establish the treatment program. Probably it would be fair to say that having crossed the Atlantic and now here we are 30 years on, it's probably taken a slightly different evolutionary path, but the core of it is this abstinence and looking at the individual as a rounded person and using the fellowship 12 steps, AANA 12 step program, as a way of providing individuals a framework for living a healthier, more fulfilled life.
Right. So I guess it's the fact that there is this big spiritual element via, which in this model is via the 12-step program, which makes it different to the hospitals or the detoxes or what have you. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you'd be saying, that it's the introduction of the spiritual element? Hi, Peter, have I lost you? I seem to be having a technical problem on my end.
BrainRadio.com.
Again, that's wonderful, and it's, I couldn't help thinking about this wonderful program. And when I read the big book, page 449, which said acceptance is the answer to all my problems today, and I knew that you were into that as well on the other end. So I just chilled out and waited for Don to call me back. It's wonderful, isn't it? So anyway, what I was saying when we had the technical problem was that would I be right in thinking then that the difference between, you know, like for example the Minnesota model and Broadway Lodge and but it, as a vis-a-vis the hospitals, the detoxes that you talked about earlier, is the introduction of the spiritual element? Would that be right?
Absolutely, yes. I think, you know, what I was saying before we cut off, and I'm not quite sure how much, you know, where we got to before I disappeared into the ether, was that, you know, that the other aspect of this Minnesota model is the 12 steps of the AANA program, which provides a framework and a structure for living lives that are much more fulfilled. But you're absolutely right that, you know, we talk about a spiritual aspect to the program, that addiction affects people physically, mentally or emotionally, and spiritually, and it would be very easy for people who would want to have a problem or reject the Minnesota model or the fellowship program, would be to focus in on the spiritual aspect and say, well, that's religion, that's religious, and you know, I'm not religious, so this can't work for me. And if I had a pound for every time I heard that said, I'd probably be quite a wealthy man. But you know, one of the big issues for people when they come into treatment is the fact that this illness has an impact on their relationships with other people, relationship with themselves, so their self-worth, and the relationship with other people, and it undermines, wears away, and so that relationships with other people becomes very superficial, if at all, you know, if it exists at all. And so for me, one of the ways in which I can help patients to better understand what we mean by the spiritual aspect of the program is that, you know, I would say to them, well, what do we mean by team spirit? It's sort of, you know, hum and ha about that one. And where we might get to in the end is that actually if we think about, maybe think about a football team, because that's sort of fairly common over here. You know, people would know about football or soccer, and you know, would maybe have particular teams that they would want to support. And so I might focus in on a result that had happened at the weekend, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and just gradually get them to begin to have a sense, gain an idea, a concept of spirituality, of the spirit, that there's something that happens between people. We're all working together for a common goal, for a common aim, and we start with that and actually build on that idea, and they can begin to start to feel the value you were talking, I was listening to you earlier, you know, coming into treatment and being met with respect, being met with care, being met with kindness. And you know, therein lies some of the, you know, the human way in which we can express our spiritual part, our spiritual being, and that's, you know, the way in which we relate to other people. And what I would say is that Broadway Lodge operates as well as it does and as effectively as it does because of the patients, because of the people that are there. The staff play a role, and you know, if they're not listening to me, I would say to the patients, look, 80% of the value of treatment comes from being with each other and working with each other. You know, the staff play a relatively minor role in this process. I mean, they certainly do play a very important role, but you know, being together and working together, giving each other feedback, giving each other support, giving each other help, working together, because you know, being in the same boat together, if we all row in the same direction, we're going to get somewhere. So they can really get a grasp of that by being with each other. And some tremendous friendships develop from the most unlikely, you know, group of people, you know, from, you know, being extremely wealthy or well-educated to somebody that's just come in off the street and, you know, or somebody that's come from psychiatric hospitals or prison. When you put them all together and you say, right, you know, look around you because these are the people that are going to help you to get well, and boy, you know, some very powerful things happen.
Technical side this evening, but that's okay. It's just another opportunity for forgiveness, as the course would tell me, and opportunity to practice patience, tolerance, and all those wonderful things. But I know that Don will eventually contact Peter again there, and Don, I'll need you to just let me know when Peter's back on the line. But I think the part that Peter Smith was just explaining there was the spiritual element of recovery and the spiritual introduction of a spirit element.
Hi, John.
Yes, Peter, we're back. I just said to our listeners there that these are wonderful opportunities for forgiveness and tolerance and patience. So here we go.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And
I think there's a lot of thunder around here at the moment, so I don't know if there's, you know, problems.
Oh, wow. And just in case some of our listeners were not aware, yeah, Peter is in southwest England at the moment, and I'm in sort of greater Vancouver in Canada. So it's amazing that what can be done. But you were just saying, Peter, about the spiritual element, and I think
yeah.
You were talking about the equality and the love between the people in that come into the into Broadway Lodge.
Yeah.
And for me,
yeah.
Spirituality is about that understanding at a deeper level that we're all connected.
Yes. Yeah.
And that
yeah.
what is happening with one is impacting the other. And I think that, for me, the understanding that that is actually a truism is, to me, one
yeah.
of the truths. And yeah. It takes away all the camouflage and stuff that, I mean, so many of us have come from this background. I know I did. I was more, you know, I had more front than Sainsbury's Superstore. like I said, I walked in dressed in a three-piece suit, you know, and I had to come in the Mercedes. I had to come in the camouflage, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was all stripped bare. And I remember the room. I don't know how it is now, but when I came in, I shared a room with, I think, five, and there were some young heroin addicts off the street, and then there was a guy probably a little bit older than me, in fact, and that he was a businessman, and then I met lawyers, and it's just incredible. Yeah. Then when all that is stripped away, when we have nothing else there, that's when the real connections are made. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, what I was saying, I don't know what point I was cut off, but you know, it's such an unlikely grouping of disparate people that come together. That, you know, as you say, you know, this illness is no respecter of age or class or education or, you know, abilities in anything, but it can affect everyone, anyone, and. You bring together these people from completely different backgrounds, and once you start to strip back the layers, some of them are very, very deep and well encrusted, but once you start to strip back the layers and get right down to the core, there's a common element there. There's a common connectivity that binds us as humans, and I would refer to that as the spiritual part of us.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree, and also the fact that religion, and no way am I knocking religion at all, but there have been a lot of negative experiences with religion, as with many other things, often puts people, puts their backs up when they first come in contact with the with the 12-step program and the word God, etc., you know, it has problems, and I think that was that's the beauty of the 12-step program, was it gave people for the first time the freedom to decide on their own concept of God.
And that
I think was so. I mean, I was fortunate that I didn't have any real negativity about it because it was never rammed down my throat. But you know, it's interesting the number of people that came from a background where that was really rammed down their throat in a negative way, with all the guilt and shame and everything. Mm-hmm.
It certainly gives them a chance to relook at that and come at it from a very different angle, and as you say, giving them the choice to choose. But you know, as long as there's a willingness to open their hearts and their minds to a different way of looking at things, and a different way of acting, a different way of being, and a different set of attitudes that are actually going to help them to have, you know, to be more fulfilled as people.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I love it when you said that willingness, because, you know, as I shared with you, I've become a student of this amazing spiritual tool called A Course in Miracles, and the one thing The Course in Miracles says that all we're required is a little bit of willingness.
Yes.
And they use the term Holy Spirit in the Course in Miracles. But whichever, you know, term you want to use, that will do the rest. And, of course, the ego doesn't even like that, because the ego likes to think we're going to do it all, you know. But that little bit of willingness. And I remember when I first started to go to the meetings, I used to hear things like, even if you don't feel you've got the willingness, just then be willing to be willing. And that was so powerful.
Yeah.
And then it goes from there. The other thing that interests me is... I mean, my own memory and perception of Broadway Lodge was a very gentle approach, and, you know, there would be challenges, etc., but I know that there have been other methods which were very, very challenging and quite harsh, and there doesn't seem to have been an awful lot of success. But you talked about one of the biggest problems being this thing that is known as denial, where, you know, there's so much defensiveness about the level of the problem or the difficulty in whatever area, you know. Do you find that is that one of the most difficult aspects to come to terms with, to get over the denial of the patients when they first come in, and how do you deal with that?
I think that it would be fair to say that people come into treatment with differing levels of denial, and denial about different aspects of their lives. Now, I think that, just listening to what you were saying about your own journey, it sounds like by the time you came to the front door of Broadway Lodge, there was an acceptance that, admitting and accepting that you had a problem with your drinking, with alcohol. What can happen for some patients coming into treatment is, whilst they might accept their addiction, they might find it more difficult to face the reality of the consequences of that addiction on the people around them.
Yeah.
They might find it difficult to acknowledge the reality of that, the impact of their behavior on loved ones.
Yeah.
So the denial can take different manifestations, and that would be one of them that for some, they don't, they can accept they've got a bit of a problem with alcohol, but, they're not quite sure why they're in treatment, because somebody else told them they had to be there, so they're being forced into treatment.
Yeah.
It can take a little while for people just to begin to allow themselves, that willingness, allow themselves to begin to be a little bit more real and listened to others talking about their process and their addiction and their consequences. By exposing people to that process, it is much more impactful, is much more effective than a member of staff saying, "Hang on a minute, you need to look at this." And what you could resistance, if there's a denial, a bit of resistance to looking at things, the more you push it, the more they're going to resist. More people are going to resist, quite understandably.
Yeah.
So you have to find different ways of challenging, different ways of confronting individuals.
Yeah.
And sometimes just exposure to other people who are a bit further on in their journey, talking about their situation, can be the thing that can make a big difference. So, what I was saying about the power and the importance of the peer group, it's very obvious in that sort of process.
Sure. And the other thing that was a big shock to me was the level at which how I found myself feeling so young, being conscious. I mean, I had all of you guys on these pedestals. You were all my teachers, and I was this little boy, and there I was probably, 20 years older than many of you, But is that a common thing that happens when you put down your... You're an anesthetic. I call it an anesthetic because basically that's what they all are.
I think anesthetic's not a bad term for it, because I guess that in reality, if we think about it, addiction, in whatever form it takes, is really about trying to medicate our feelings, trying to keep the feelings away somewhere. so anesthetize, avoid them or whatever. But coming back to your question there, I think that what tends to happen when once addiction takes off, I think at that point our growth, personal growth, stops or slows down.
Emotional growth.
Emotional growth, particularly.
Right.
So physically we carry on growing. So, let's imagine that addiction started sort of mid-teens, maybe. Started drinking.
Yeah, in my case, I was 10.
Okay, so it's maybe drinking, maybe it's cannabis, and then it's maybe heroin, and then the whole thing then sort of takes off. So, early teens, mid-teens, maybe. And then come to us for treatment, come to Broadway Lodge for treatment, let's say, age 30, for instance. Between the age of, let's say the addiction started at 15, between the age of 15 and 30, not an awful lot of emotional growth has happened. Physical growth, So here we are at 30.
And mental growth could also happen without a problem.
Yeah. I mean,
it's the emotional side.
There's a lot of, a lot of the growth that would happen for somebody that doesn't have this illness gets stunted. So pop out the other end at 30 with this body of a 30-year-old, and the emotional makeup and mental sort of approach to life that's still in the 15s or sort of mid-teens to late teens.
I can really relate to that.
Well, and it's not unusual for patients. Let's take the 30-year-old in early recovery, who's actually, suddenly discovered, lots of exciting things in life for themselves, but also that, hang on a minute, but what about relationships? I've never actually had a quality relationship without addiction being present.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to be, you know. I don't know how to have sex without something inside me, you know.
Yeah.
And how do I... And so, the 30-year-old, with all of that sort of, you know, charm and naivety and innocence of the sort of 15-year-old at an emotional sort of level. So, the good news is, it catches up fairly quickly. You're not going to be, left, you know, so with 15 years adrift for the rest of your life. So it does catch up, but you know, there is something about coming out the other side with that sort of a bit of naivety and innocence.
Yeah. Yeah, and do you see, you know, in my book, Addicts and Angels, it's one of the things I kind of highlight is the commonality between people who I've met on this journey who become, you know, really into the healing and the caring and the helping others and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the similarities that I used to hear and still do, you know, around people recovering from addiction, like, you know, I always felt as a child that I didn't fit in. I was told that I was too sensitive, and I never felt I fitted in with anyone. You know, and then suddenly I found that these people who I've met on amazing courses, you know, all sharing the same thing. And I think my experience is that people that find that they need to go down that route, they do have this sensitivity, which of course becomes a tremendous strength. When they get rid of the damaging parts of, you know, the actual addiction, then that turns around to an amazing strength because they have empathy, they have understanding, and they have the ability to connect with people and understanding. So did you, on the other side of the fence, so to speak, on the counseling side, and did you used to find this, generally speaking, amongst the client base?
I think that's a fair comment. I think that people coming into treatment, you know, often, I think because of their own journey, and also because of the treatment that they've received, they acquire a knowledge, you know, and an experience that supports the development of their sort of role, which maybe in other situations, other circumstances, would not have been valued in any way.
Right.
But coming into treatment, you know, I've never met a patient in treatment that's not resourceful, that's not got an intelligence and a sensitivity and a caring that couldn't, if it was harnessed, be put to some very good use. And it's not unusual for people, you know, at the end of treatment to say, you know, I'd quite like to be a counsellor. You know, I quite like to work in helping other people. And, I mean, one of the things we do have to say, certainly for ourselves, is, look, hang on a minute, that's absolutely great, you know, but go off and live. You know, go off and settle into your recovery and you know, get it well established and firmed up. And then, you know, a few years down the line, if it's something that you're still thinking of, give me a ring and I'll try and point you in the direction where you can get the qualification to go with the experience and the knowledge that you have, which then may create an opening for you in the caring profession.
Yeah, I mean, I so relate to that, and I so agree with that. I mean, you know, I can remember after 3 weeks thinking, "Wow, I'm really getting to this." And then, of course, when I eventually came out, I realized I had so much more to go. Because for me, the important thing was I realized when I came out of treatment that this definitely was the first stage.
Yeah.
An essential stage, absolutely essential, one where I'll never forget, and it always has this real special place in my heart because of that, and that there was still a lot of healing. And I think it's, you know, I remember a line in the big book that said something, that's the big book of AA, you know, that said our drinking was we realized our drinking was a symptom of a far deeper problem. And I think that was it. And I really wanted to make sure that I continued clearing out that deeper problem, and as I did, I realized as well how quickly and easily it was to mask my own experience or feelings if I focused on trying to help somebody else. So that's a very subtle thing, because on the surface it looks very admirable, And I think that's where the awareness comes in, and the self-honesty, I think.
I think one of the problems that if people go too quickly back in, having completed treatment and started their own recovery process, I think if they go back into the caring professions too quickly, there's, part of the risk is that they project onto other people what they have to do in order to get well, because this is what they did, so that's what other people have to do.
Yeah.
And then they miss the empathy, they miss the listening to the other person clearly enough, uncluttered by their own stuff. And therefore they can then become too prescriptive. What you have to do is this, rather than listening and trying to understand from that person's perspective what might help them.
And I think this is the one thing I it's about that every individual's journey is unique to themselves. And honoring that, and I think that was one thing that I felt very strongly about, within the rooms, and that was to be able to honor that, what's best for me may not be best for the other person. And to allow people to find that way. And my goodness me, I really had some flat on my face experiences in the early days. I made all those mistakes, I had to learn that was part of learning. And
I think that I can think back myself, and when I started in this career path, that I thought I had all the answers, and I thought counselling was about, and psychotherapy was about advice, and this is what you need to do, and if you try that, and and I suddenly realised actually I was doing all the work, the other person was can't do that. So I was trying to think of yet more imaginative ways, and eventually I said, well, hang on a minute, maybe I'm just not listening to what they're saying. Maybe they're not ready to do that, but maybe they could, they might be ready to do this, but I need to be listening better.
Well, and that's, I think that's one of the wonderful things that that I felt Broadway Lodge offered. There was a wide variety. I mean, I can remember. Do they still do the weekly? Oh my God, this brings back memories. I can remember getting into my togs, my tracksuit bottoms, and my trainers, and doing aerobics.
Aerobics.
We used to have once a week. They still have the compulsory aerobics.
John, we don't call it compulsory. We say there's a therapeutic expectation for that read compulsory. they still do that, and they
had a voluntary one, isn't it, when you were invited to it. So there was an opportunity anyway to do twice a week, and I got in there, and I think that many times I was the only man. And I felt like a complete and utter dum-dum, and I found it so difficult, to get into that coordination. My brain was only just starting to work, for goodness sake. But it was a lot
It's absolutely, if you can just, grasp a moment when you're in there. I mean, I've done it as well, in there, and there's, 20 or so, alcoholics, addicts, older, younger, taller, thinner, fatter, all doing it.
Coordination.
Big smile to your face, but, is this possible?
I mean, I'm picturing the room now and everything, and can't remember, what's the first name of the lady that ran it?
We've now got an Anne. We've got somebody called Anne who replaced the previous incumbent. And Anne comes in. Actually, she comes in twice a week now. She comes in on a Wednesday morning, and she comes in on a Friday afternoon. And Wednesday is a therapeutic expectation, and Friday is voluntary. So only the hardened ones do it twice a week, and most of the others, try their best to find ways of getting out of it.
It's amazing. And how many people do Broadway Lodge, can you accommodate now, Peter, at one time?
Right. Well, we've got a primary care setting where patients will work through steps 1 to 5 of the fellowship program, and in that setting we've got 34 beds. And it's an 8-week program. At the end of that time, if patients want, and there are places available, then and funding's possible. Then we have a secondary care unit that's at the bottom of the grounds, where we have a number of houses, and there's we can accommodate 22 patients in,
oh, wow,
in the secondary care setting.
So that's a total of
quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, Peter, it's been fabulous having you on. Thank you for coming on this evening. Oh, this will be my your time this afternoon.
My pleasure.
I'm back and I'm just getting over the jet lag. Would you like to tell our listeners, do you have a website that you can give them where if they want to know more about Broadway Lodge in particular that you can give?
Yeah, we have a website. I mean, I will just apologize for it at the moment because we're in the process of you know, replacing it, upgrading it, and rebranding it, and all the rest of the sort of terminology that's used. And it's www.broadwaylodge.org.uk.
Okay, so that's www.broadwaylodge.org.uk.
That's it.
That's wonderful, and thank you again for coming on. And if any of our listeners would like to know more about Broadway Lodge, I do invite you to visit the website and our own website, which is www.theangelproject.org. And I look forward to sharing another interesting journey, stage of the journey, with you all next Tuesday between 12 and 1 Pacific Standard Time, or 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. British Summertime. So thank you, Peter, and have a wonderful rest of the evening, and I'll speak to you again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, and apologize for the technical hiccups, but from all of us here, love on the way, and speak to you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.